We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is hour number two of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. At first glance, a price might seem to be only a number. However, our guest for this hour, William Poundstone, says that a price can evoke a very complex set of emotions, something that can even be seen on a brain scan. And depending on the context, he says, the same price can either be seen as a bargain or as a ripoff. And getting consumers to see the one and not the other involves some of the most innovative work in recent psychology. This morning, in this hour of Focus 580, we'll talk some about the hidden psychology of value. That is the subject of William Poundstone's new book. The title is Priceless: The Myth of Fair Value and How to Take Advantage of It. It's published by Hill and Wang. He's the author of more than 10 nonfiction books, including Fortune's Formula, The Untold Story of the Scientific Betting System That Beat the Casinos in Wall Street, that was published in 2005, and also Gaming the Vote, Why Elections Aren't Fair and What We Can Do About It, that was published in 2008. And all three of these books that I've mentioned, those two and the new one, all published by Hill and Wang. So if you're interested, you can seek out the books. And as we talk here on Focus 580, questions are welcome. Now, you can participate in a couple of ways. You can call here in Champaign-Urbana. The number is 333-9455. We have a toll-free line, so if it's a long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. And you may also email will-talk@illinois.edu. And joining us on the telephone, William Poundstone. Mr. Poundstone, hello.
Yes, it's good to be with you.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it. It's a very interesting subject and certainly one that touches everybody, although it's something that probably most of us don't think very much about. I think that, you know, we're told that we should be thoughtful consumers. There are groups that try to educate us and get us to think about that. But it seems that when it comes down to it, and this seems to be a fundamental idea that's at the heart of the book, is that truly we really don't know what anything should cost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they actually have a term for that. It's called coherent arbitrariness, which basically means that people sort of tell themselves they know what things are worth, but they really don't. You don't have a price sense. Instead, you respond to all sorts of external cues telling you this is worth this, this is worth that. And what they found is that those cues can very easily be manipulated, and that's what a lot of people are doing nowadays. There's a profession called price consultants who are really using a lot of this recent psychology of decision-making to basically get consumers to pay more for less.
Is part of this related to innumeracy? That is the fact and I will count myself as someone who just has trouble with numbers. That generally anything that has to do with numbers, it's difficult for us to wrap our brains around.
Yeah, exactly. They found for one thing that the human mind can only deal with a few numbers at once. So in any sort of thinking about prices, the last number you hear really has an overwhelming effect on your decision of whether that's a right price or not. Another study that came out recently, which I thought was very amusing, you know, if you go to the supermarket, you probably see a lot of these specials like 10 for $10.
Mm-hmm.
They become very popular maybe with the Great Recession and all. They did a study and found that 40% of consumers could not answer the question, if it's 10 for $10, how much would one cost? So that shows you that, you know, people do have some problems with numbers, and a lot of the marketers are taking advantage of that.
Yeah, I was just recently, it was in a situation where I was with an acquaintance, and they had one of their kids there, and the kid was supposed to be working on his homework, and he was doing math problems. And so we were sitting and talking, and he was saying something about how he had 30 that he needed to do, and he had done 15. And so I just very jokingly sort of said, okay, if you had 30 problems to do and you'd done 15 of them, what percentage of the problems remain? And he freaked out. And he said, what? I don't know. What are you talking about? And I'm thinking, well, first of all, I'm thinking, okay, I'm just joking around here. And then I'm thinking, well, now, really, you really can't tell me that that's half and that's 50%, but he just asked him, it was as if I'd asked him, you know, to walk from here to the moon.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really surprised, particularly, again, because I, you know, I'm not really all that sharp with numbers, but that one, I could do that one myself.
Well, to put a slightly more positive spin on it, it's not just that we're stupid, it's that we've got limited attention. When you're in the supermarket, you know, the kids are yelling for you to buy this and buy that. You're trying to make a cell phone conversation. You really don't have a lot of attention to expend on prices. And so they have something like 3 for $7.49. I mean, you really don't do the math because you just have more things on your plate. So again, that can cause people to make some very costly mistakes.
And I think that it's also true. We know that product manufacturers, they do things that make it very difficult for us to do comparison shopping, mm-hmm. to decide if I buy this one or this one, where do I get the better deal, doing things with pricing and doing things with the packaging and doing things with the sizes and how they offer stuff, mm-hmm. that they are trying to confuse us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they used to say that, you know, now that everyone's got a smartphone, it's very easy to compare prices on the Internet. But they're really fighting back with that. One of the things they do is that they have these model numbers that are like 17 digits, which are very hard to punch correctly into an iPhone or something. So it's hard even if you try to do the right thing and compare prices.
Well, just at the beginning, I tossed out this idea, and I know it's something that you write in a book, that people have a difficult time figuring out what things are worth, mm-hmm. and that people who sell products know that, and they take advantage of how it is we try to establish this, which comes to a notion that is, I think, again, a central concept in the book, and that is anchoring. Talk mm-hmm. about anchoring.
Yeah, anchoring, a psychologist named Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, who are really some of the most influential psychologists of our time, studied how people make decisions. And one of the things they found was that any time you have to estimate a numerical value, you're incredibly influenced by the last number you hear. Now, the way that would work in retail, say you walk into a really fancy store like Prada. They're going to have very prominently displayed, say, a $12,000 handbag. And the first thing everyone does is you kind of shake your head and say, who would be crazy enough to spend $12,000 on a handbag? But next to that handbag, they're going to have one that's maybe $2,000 and another that's maybe $800. And the thing is, suddenly you decide that those cheaper handbags really are kind of reasonable, even though, you know, it's $1,200. And they've actually found from studies that you end up buying those bags just because they're cheaper, whereas if they didn't have that $17,000 bag, you would have rejected the $1,200 one as too expensive. This is what they call anchoring, and it's a very powerful trick. I compare it in the book to what a magician does. They really control what you see, what you notice, and what you think is happening. And they really don't care if they sell that $17,000 bag because its real purpose is to sort of bewitch you into deciding that the $2,000 bag is actually pretty reasonable.
Yeah, so they may indeed sell one of those every once in a while, but it sounds as if they really don't care if they sell the $17,000 bag as long as I can sell enough of the $800 and the $200 bags.
Exactly. And, of course, the $17,000 bag didn't cost them that. With all mm-hmm. these luxury goods, the price of materials and labor is a tiny part of the actual retail price.
So it seems to be that if we're offered a range of choices and we're offered a choice that clearly seems to be completely outrageous, mm-hmm. that'll end up being a kind of a benchmark. We'll say, okay, well, that's clearly outrageous, but then it starts to become sort of relative what gets to be reasonable. And if you set the bar high enough at the top, then you can get someone to feel that, again, an amount that might clearly also seem to be outrageous seems much more Well, that seems much more reasonable.
Yeah, one of the things that psychologist Amos Tversky was aware of and which really influenced him, the Williams-Sonoma chain had a bread maker for $275. And then they added the second bigger one for about $450. Now, the more expensive one totally flopped. No one wanted to buy it because who needs a bigger bread maker? But the thing was, the sales of the cheaper one doubled just because they offered this more expensive one. Now, at that time, they didn't know about anchoring, and this was probably unintentional, but they've done studies in psychology labs where this really does have effect, and now, you know, all the smart marketers are doing it.
How, perhaps you can talk a little bit about how this field of psychology over time, that is, trying to investigate how people feel about these things, how they judge worth, how it is that field has grown, and then how it's also people who do marketing, who sell things, then try to take what that field has discovered and turn that to their advantage.
Exactly. This started in the 1970s when a group of psychologists were really just interested in finding out how the human mind works. And one of the things they looked at was how do we make decisions, particularly when those decisions involve numbers. And they found that people really didn't have a clear-cut notion of what something was worth. The decision could really be manipulated in all sorts of different ways. And so some of these articles started appearing in the psychology journals, and then marketers got wind of it and said, hey, this is something we can really use. So in the 1980s, a company called Simon Kucher & Partners got started. Now, they're really the first example of what we call a price consultant. And a big motivation was the new psychology, as I was saying, but also the fact that that they started having barcode scanning and internet sales. So you got all this quantitative data on what people had bought, what sort of sales and promotions they responded to, and what sort of ones they ignored. So they're using that in conjunction with the psychology to really find the way to get people to pay more money. And it's become a very profitable business, this price consulting. If you look at the client list of Simon Kucher & Partners, it practically reads like the Fortune 500. As I say, you know, an ad agency would not have Coke and Pepsi as clients, but both of them are clients of Simon Kucher, because apparently a lot of the same psychology is used in deciding what to charge for Coke and Pepsi. But they also advise for Procter & Gamble, Microsoft, the big cell phone companies, airlines. They pretty much figure that the same psychology works whether you're selling airline tickets or toilet paper. So it's become a very hot business.
Mm-hmm. So there seem to be sort of two notions that get coupled together, and yet they're different. They're really two different things, and that is the price. That is price. That is, you know, what's written on the ticket that's attached to the thing. If we're talking about something we want to buy, price on the one hand and value on the other, which are really very different. And how it is we assign value to something and then are willing to pay a certain price still seems to be a little mysterious. You know, for example, here at one point in the book, you're talking about watches, and you're talking about the fact that you can go out and you can buy a Timex for maybe about $40, and it will tell you what time it is and probably, you know, maybe do a bunch of other stuff too. Or you can go and you can buy yourself a Rolex President, which is the watch. It's gold and it has a big gold bracelet and it's very big and flashy, and big and flashy people like to wear them. Well, that costs about $30,000, and it will also tell you what time it is. So then, so if you want to know what time it is, and that's the only thing you're interested in, the most cost-effective probably is to buy the Timex. But clearly here we're talking about something that is more than simply an appliance to tell you what time it is.
Yeah, the ironic thing is when something is a status symbol like a Rolex, basically the value as a status symbol goes up in proportion to the cost. So there's really no clear limit to what they can charge for that sort of thing. And again, there's a lot of anchoring at work. They'll offer these outrageously expensive watches, but it'll still get people to want to buy a somewhat less expensive Rolex, saying, hey, it's still a Rolex, it still tells the time, and, you know, people won't really know what I paid for it. So in that sense, they get people at all different income levels wanting to buy their product.
We have a caller here. We'd like to involve some others. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. You may email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we are talking in this hour of Focus 580 with William Poundstone. He is the author of the book Priceless, The Myth of Fair Value and How to Take Advantage of It. It is published by Hill and Wang, just out recently. You can find it, I'm sure, in the bookstore or in the library if you don't want to pay the, I don't know, how much is it? $26.99, everyday low price of $26.99, although I'm sure Mr. Poundstone would be happy if you would go out and buy a copy of the book. Anyway, questions welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILO. Here's a caller in Indiana on our toll-free line, line number four. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. A couple things about pricing. When I was working, started in high school and in college and stuff, I got to the place a lot of times where I was sort of a co-manager, assistant manager, and I noticed a lot of times that the markup was 100% for about everything. If a spark plug cost 50 cents, we charged a dollar for it and things like that. So I wonder if there's any psychology going on that, whether that's just something that's coincidental I came across in my work habits or whatever. The next thing is Walmart. I have sworn to a number of people, and a couple of them have agreed to me, that at times Walmart will put something on sale costing more than what it did originally. And the reason I say that, because I was in a place where they were, you know, putting the for sale signs up, and they didn't change the, you know, the $49.95 at all. They just added for sale, $49.95. And I was wondering if there's a name for that. And then the overall thing is the ethics behind this sort of thing. Somehow there's almost like the classic case of where's the pea under the shell, is that taking that knowledge that psychologists are handing out is, in some sense, for a fellow from the 60s, is like the Wisconsin psychology department doing things for the defense department and the mathematics department, and they got blowed up. I was just wondering where things are hanging now on this sort of thing about people's reaction to seeing how they're actually being manipulated and don't know it and are being done to it by academics. Thanks.
Well, starting with the spark plugs and so forth, they've certainly found that anything to do with auto repair, the average consumer really has a very vague idea of what the wholesale cost of the various parts are. So that's certainly a case where they have a lot of freedom to charge a lot more, and a lot of customers will pay that. So that's why they tend to do that. As to you were talking about Walmart, I guess, basically my understanding is when they say something is on sale, they have to have charged more for it, but it could be for a very short time. And that's something you actually saw this past Christmas season, where you basically had wall-to-wall sales. I mean, it started before Black Friday, and it continued well into January. That was partly because they were afraid with the economy that, you know, they really needed something to get people into the stores. But in most cases, what they did way back in October, they put something, you know, on sale for a relatively high price, and they knew it wasn't going to sell at that price. But that allowed them to say, we're giving you a 40% discount or a 70% discount. And the reason they do that is there are so many studies showing that people really do respond to discounts. And it's above and beyond the actual price. I mean, what should really matter is this worth the price I'm paying, not that it's supposedly a discount from such and such a price. But that's not the way people think. In trying to make that decision of whether I should take money out of my pocket and buy this, they try to convince themselves, and they sort of imagine, you know, how you would explain it to your spouse or your friends. And if you can say, you know, I save 70% on this, basically people's price resistance vanishes as long as they can say that. So that's why you saw an awful lot of sales claiming these incredibly steep discounts. Now, the ethical angle is really quite interesting, and it is something I talk a little about in the book. Back in, I suppose, the Mad Men era, they figured that consumers know what they want. They know how much they're willing to pay for it. And we had to find out, you know, what is their reserve price, what do they really want, and find a way of pitching it to them. But what they're finding now is that there really isn't this inner value sense. People really don't know how much they're willing to pay for something. And even in the natural state of affairs, your decision is going to be, determined by a lot of very incidental factors. One of the people I spoke with, Eric Johnson, said that, you know, he teaches marketing at Columbia. He used to start his classes saying that, you know, this isn't about manipulating the consumer. It's about finding out what the consumer wants and then trying to give it to them. But he said after teaching a few years and really getting into this anchoring and other psychological tricks, he realized that basically you can manipulate the consumer. And in a sense, although no one likes to be told that they're being manipulated, in a sense, it's like, you know, a fish not wanting to feel wet. There are so many things in the environment that can affect your choices that it's almost inevitable that you're going to be, to some extent, manipulated by that. So I think it's true that there are some mixed feelings in the field, both among the academics and I suppose among the price consultants about all of this. And it's something that we're still kind of coming to terms with, because even our ethical sense is to some extent predicated on the old idea that people know exactly what they want and how much they're willing to pay for it. And that seems not to be true. Mm.
You know, I do wonder about the business of markdowns, particularly at these times of year when retailers are really hoping that they can get people to come into the store to buy things. And I suppose that the run up to Christmas is maybe the biggest time. And it seems that that now retailers have almost trained us to look for markdowns. Now, you could say that they're manipulating us by setting the price high to begin with so that then they can take the markdown. But I also wonder whether they have taught people that if they wait, the price will continue to come down. And what I wonder is how it is that people then finally decide, if it's an item that they truly want, mm-hmm. how they finally decide, all right, now you've arrived at the price that I'm willing to pay and that I will then put down my money or my plastic and mm-hmm. buy the thing.
Yeah, there is a sort of balancing act. I mean, they don't want the consumers to expect that prices will always keep going down. But you kind of know, generally the January prices, are going to be about as low as they're going to be. But part of the reasons these things are so effective is that so many of our products today are really so complicated and technological. If you're looking at flat-screen TVs, it would be very hard to be a smart consumer who really knows how the features of this particular model stack up to that one. Instead, you're going to be looking a lot at prices. And since prices are so salient, I mean, they're on a big tag on them, they play an incredibly important part in your decision. And if you see one TV that's marked like $1,200 and another that's marked $1,300, you're going to assume that the $1,300 is worth more. And if that $1,300 also comes with a coupon that's good for a $100 rebate, you're certainly more likely to pick that one rather than the $1,200 one that actually costs the same price. So that's why these schemes like discounts and rebates are so popular. They certainly aren't logical, but they do have this emotional pull on people. And it used to be they sort of figured that couldn't be that important, but they're realizing it is.
Yeah, that's, I think, another one of the points you make, that rebates really make no sense, because you'd have to figure that the people who were selling it had taken the rebate into account in the pricing of the item. So they're not giving anything away, but for us, that just makes it seem that much more attractive, as if we're somehow getting more.
Yeah, it's known as the silver lining effect. No one likes to be spending money, but if you can get, something a little more, it's like the rebates with cars, people feel good about that, and it makes them more inclined to buy. Now, as I say, rebates are a big profit center for companies nowadays because, first of all, they know that a lot of people, even though the rebate motivates you to buy, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're actually going to go to the trouble of filling out the coupon and getting, the the price code tag and everything else that you have to send in to get your rebate. Plus, the companies that send out the rebate checks have gotten very tricky about it. They will generally send out those checks in envelopes that are carefully engineered to look and feel like junk mail, so that a lot of them just end up in the trash.
On to another caller here, someone in Charleston on line one. Hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to ask again about the ethical issues. And I appreciate the spirit, I think, of the author's book. I'd like to add, this Danish philosopher, Soren Kierkegaard, I think he once referred to psychology as a venture into the dark arts. And when it's used to manipulate people, I can definitely see that face of psychology. Now, I'm aware of an ethical committee that guides the research portion of psychology, but is there anything in place like that, a committee, or even rules or laws that govern the use of that psychological research by these companies?
Yeah, there are very strict guidelines for academic research, but once you get into the price consultants and the retailers, they're basically regulated only by the standard fair trade regulation, which really doesn't take into account this new psychology. So they're allowed legally to do a lot of these tricks, which I think your dark arts thing is a very good analogy, because it really is like a magician. They know that you will look at the rebate and not at how much you're actually paying. They know that certain prices, like those ending in 9, seem to be incredibly effective in getting people to buy. And there's really no regulation on that. I think that there is a disconnect between how our laws and ethics work and what we've learned in psychology just in the past 10 or 20 years.
If I could ask a follow-up question,
sure.
Is there any backlash from the academic community in the way that their research is being used sometimes? And is there a movement from them to change the laws?
I actually ask a lot of them about that, like Daniel Kahneman. He's not crazy about the idea that that it's being used for things like this. But again, some of the very major psychologists working in behavioral economists have published in marketing journals, so they seem to be, okay with the idea that this would be used in the marketplace in some sense, at least. There has been a little talk about, getting lawmakers maybe a little more aware of this, but so far there's not any legislation I know of.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Other questions are certainly welcome. We're a little bit past our midpoint. The guest this morning is William Poundstone. He's the author of more than 10 nonfiction books, among them Fortune's Formula, The Untold Story of the Scientific Betting System that Beat the Casinos in Wall Street, also more recent, Gaming the Vote, Why Elections Aren't Fair and What We Can Do About It. And his new book is Priceless, The Myth of Fair Value and How to Take Advantage of It. All these three titles I mentioned, they're all published by Hill and Wang. Books out now in the bookstore. Questions here are welcome, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. I want to just for a moment to go back to the mystery of 9, because I think it's a fascinating thing, and this would explain why, for example, if you go to buy a song on iTunes, most of them cost 99 cents and not a dollar. For some reason, we really like $9.99 as a price much better than we like $10. Why?
Yeah. Well, that's a good question. When Apple started iTunes, they really consulted with a lot of these consultants, because they had an uphill climb convincing people who were getting music for absolutely free to pay money for it. And one of the things they found was effective was charging 99 cents. Now, if you look back, prices ending in 9 go back at least to the 19th century. Macy's was having prices for things like $4.99 even back then. And for a long time, economists kind of dismissed this. They said, this is a retailer's superstition. It really can't affect how consumers think. Now, there were theories that people are just rounding down. Like if you see something for $4.99, you assume, well, it's about $4 instead of saying it's about $5. But there have been some studies challenging that. In one, some psychologists got a catalog company to print up two versions of its catalog, and they would sell the exact same item for two different prices. So some people would receive a catalog saying this item is $34, and others would get one saying this item is $39. Well, they found that more people bought it at $39. So it seems to be that when you see 39, you assume that it's been discounted, maybe just a dollar from $40. But that creates this silver lining effect, as I say, because you can justify it, well, it's cheaper than it used to be or something. And they found this is very effective, but probably most effective at all with a price like 99 cents. Another use of that, there's a chain of stores, the 99-cent store, which is basically a dollar store, but it cost one penny less. That started when a guy named Dave Gold, who ran a liquor store, had all this cheap wine that wasn't selling. So he figured what he'd do, he'd just put it all together, everything that no one wanted, and put a sign over it saying, anything on this shelf, 99 cents. Now, a lot of the things that hadn't been selling had originally been priced at 79 cents. So he was actually raising the price to 99 cents. But when he did that, the wine quickly sold out. So he joked to friends, you know, someday he ought to open a store where everything was priced 99 cents. And that joke became reality, and it's now this huge, 99-cent store chain. And the interesting thing is their gross profit margin is twice that of Walmart. They actually pay about 60 cents on the average for the things that they're selling for 99 cents. So they make an incredible markup, and it's really because of that price.
On again to another caller, someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi, good morning. I had a question for the author.
Sure.
I'm a graduate student here in Illinois, and I was wondering what his educational background is and how someone would get started writing nonfiction books. I'm a generalist. I have actually a degree in psychology, and I'm studying history now. So any advice?
Yeah, well, I actually studied physics at MIT, and after that I went into publishing, and I've started writing articles, and I've been writing nonfiction books for like 25 years now. So it's something I really enjoyed. This particular topic, I had read a lot about Kahneman and Tversky, and everything I read about them seemed fascinating, so I thought it would be neat to do some sort of book about them. But then I found out that their work was being used by all these sort of, hucksters and marketers to promote products. So it seemed that was kind of an interesting how something that started out being really trying to understand how the mind works was kind of used and even perverted in a way, you might say, to cause consumers to pay more for products. So it became a very fascinating story.
So can I follow up?
Yeah.
So you normally start out with an idea and then just try to get it published through an article or a book, or how do you
usually I just write a proposal and I have an agent and they shop it around to publishers.
Okay. All right. Thank you very
much.
All right.
Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. I got an email here just came in. The emailer wonders how it is that you can, after knowing all these tricks of advertising and what people do to manipulate buyers, she asks, how can you buy anything now that you know all of this?
Well, it certainly has changed my experience of going to the supermarket or a department store, because now you see all these tricks, and I suppose to some extent being forewarned is forearmed. But I've also talked to some of the psychologists about this, and they kind of warn me. I mean, these tricks are like if I tell you don't think of an elephant, you have to think of an elephant. And a lot of these tricks, are going to work even if you understand them. One of the researchers, Donald Lichtenstein, has done a lot of work on this idea of advertised reference prices, where they will say, this tennis racket used to be $700, now it's only $400. And he was buying tennis rackets, and even though he wrote some of the classic articles on this, and he's a complete expert on it, he found that he was paying attention to the discounts as much as the prices. I mean, he knew better, but he couldn't help himself. So I think a lot of these tricks do kind of work that way, and that's why they're so powerful.
To another caller. This is Champagne, line number one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes. Go ahead.
A very interesting show. This is really not a question, but just a very brief comment. I grew up in a family-owned business, and my father taught me how to add numbers very quickly so that I could arrive at a discount for our customers, and it's very simply done by rounding up or rounding down to the next zero or five, and then coming up with that total and deducting the small amounts. As a result, now when I shop, I can figure out how much it costs per individual item by simply using that method. I wonder what the author thinks of that method.
No, that sounds great, and that's what we all should do. But they've just found that in so many situations, you know, people just have so much on their plate, they're thinking about other things, and they end up not doing that. It tends to be a very instinctive process. You sort of look at, you know, a jar of ketchup, figure how much is in there, look at the price, and figure whether that's a good deal or not, and then you toss it in your cart or not. So they get very good at manipulating that. One of the things they do, I was told that the reason the Heinz ketchup is in this very tall bottle that everyone says is hugely impractical because you can't get the ketchup out, but they've done studies showing that when you're estimating the volume of a liquid, you're much more impressed if it's in a tall, narrow container than in a short, squat one. So basically, it looks like you're getting more ketchup, and the price they charge looks like a good deal. So that's why even when they tried to have a more sensible container, the public just didn't buy it.
So image is key in order to mask reality.
That should be the slogan of a lot of these people, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. And it seems that would be the kind of thing that would be you could easily figure out that was happening if you just looked at the package and looked at, because it says how much there is in there by
exactly.
Ounces, you know, so you could clearly see, even though that one might look a little different, that the one sitting right next, you know, the squat one sitting next to it actually has more ketchup in it. So that, you know, it wouldn't take any great feat of mathematical reasoning to do that. It's right there on the package. But it sounds as if people just don't do it.
Well, not only that, but they've got unit pricing in most markets now where you can look and see how much it is per ounce.
It's right there on the shelf.
Yes. Now, when that first came in, they thought this is going to be a new age. Everyone will buy based on that. What they've found is it's hardly made any difference at all. There are a few smart customers who will do it, and I mean, I've done it sometimes, but so much of shopping is sort of reflex action. You're kind of on autopilot. You just don't have time to look at every unit price there, and a lot of it is force of habit. A lot of it is just what looks like it's a good deal.
All right. We go on to some other callers here. A cell phone caller next from Kankakee, line number four. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Great show. Just wanted to relate, my father worked for a retailer in Sears and on State Street 50s and 60s, and he used to drive him nuts because during the summer in Chicago, of course, they'd advertise this $99 air conditioner, you know, and maybe they would have 5 units on hand. Well, of course, they were gone. This is all intentional, of course. They were gone within the first half hour. But the customer's there, so of course they turn to the more expensive product, more expensive air conditioner. I think perhaps there are some laws in place now, truth in advertising or something, where that's been rectified. But also retailers like Walmart, whatever, they use something called a loss leader, where you know you might have a sale on toothpaste for 69 cents, so you go in there because it's such a good price. But obviously they know. 9 times out of 10, you're not only going to buy the toothpaste, but you're going to walk away with a number of other items. But my question is to the guest, if you could speak to subliminal advertising, if it's effective, if it in fact is real. Case in point is it might be an advertisement for a lady cleaning a floor, and there's lady on her knees, and she's kind of a drudge, and she's scrubbing, and of course you have this beautiful model in a dress and pearls, and she's squirting this cleaner on the floor, and basically both floors are getting clean, but we know we are being manipulated, but still, in all, it seems to be effective, and I was wondering if you could speak to that. Thanks.
Yeah, well, I actually did some research on subliminal advertising as one of sort of the precedents for this. The original subliminal advertising thing way back in the 1950s was since revealed to be a hoax. This guy said, James Vickery said, that he had projected very quick, fleeting messages saying, buy Coca-Cola in a movie theater, and this had caused concession stand sales to go up. But he later confessed that he had just made this up, that he wanted to get all these consultancy fees from companies. But what's interesting is that a lot of the recent research, although it's not on subliminal advertising or subliminal effects, is really showing that prices and other things can be just as sneaky in causing people to decide to buy something or not. For instance, they did one study where they changed the background music that was played in a wine store. And they found that when they played French music, the sales of French wine went up, and it was statistically significant. When they played German music, the sales of German wine went up. And they interviewed some of the people who bought the wine and asked them, you know, did the background music have any effect on your choice? And, of course, they said that was ridiculous. You know, it's Muzak. Who pays attention to that? And yet it did affect what they buy. So they're discovering lots of things like that, and I think just with the fact that everything's digital now and they have, you know, scanning and Internet sales, they're going to find out various ways that they can manipulate people, not necessarily by subliminal advertising, but by things that are just as sneaky, by things that are sort of in the background, in plain sight, which do have an effect on what you decide to buy.
About 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. We'll have several callers. Try to get in as many as we can. Just a reminder again that you're listening to William Poundstone. He's the author of the recent book Priceless, The Myth of Fair Value and How to Take Advantage of It, published by Hill and Wang. And our next caller should be in someone in Chicago, line number two. Hello.
Yeah, hi, thank you. Well, I've often felt that advertising in general should just be outlawed, but I'm sure never go anywhere because it would be considered free speech or something. Actually, it appears mostly to be just the right to lie to people. I remember when I was a kid, my parents took me on a tour of the River Rouge plant, and the Ford employee touring us very proudly told everybody that they had an entire department of over six people, full-time employees, who did nothing but design the sound that the car doors made when they closed, because psychologically you wanted this solid, luscious sound when the door latched closed, but it had absolutely nothing to do with whether the door stayed closed or worked well, just that the sound sounded right. I wonder if you have any idea how many psychology majors are employed by private business for these purposes of deception.
Well, it is, I suppose to some extent it depends on what you call deception. I mean, I think the really scary thing about advertising is that they don't even have to lie to you. They found that something called mere exposure, that just if you're exposed to the name, like Skippy Peanut Butter, Skippy Peanut Butter, that you will be more likely to buy Skippy Peanut Butter. And that's why a lot of ads today don't even really, you know, they aren't so hard sell. They don't really make any claims. They're just about making sure that people are familiar with the brand. Now, that certainly describes a lot of the Super Bowl commercials. And they found that, you know, just being exposed to the brand can make a big difference in sales. So I don't know. I mean, you can't really outlaw something that isn't lying. But it is kind of, you know, interesting the way that advertising works in that sense.
And does that also apply to advertising for political candidates?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, in many cases, it's just the candidate who gets their name out there the best that has a huge advantage.
All right. Let's talk with someone here in Champaign on a cell phone, line three. Hello.
Oh, hello.
Yes.
Good morning.
Yes.
Yes. So the first thing I have is a comment, and this is about unit pricing. And while it's a good idea, it sometimes drives me crazy. So, for example, I was in a grocery store looking at paper towels, and they were unit priced either by sheet or by weight, or by diameter of the roll. And there's absolutely no way to tell them apart. Okay, so, So that's my first comment. I have two interrelated questions for you, and that is, it seems to me that part of the issue here would be the ability to bargain, and the only place that I really know in which you have bargaining capacity, perhaps, is in buying cars, right? And there, it's still weighted highly towards the seller, but you know, you can always walk, is what you can do. So the two interrelated questions are there other places in which you can bargain? And then the other related question to that is, what is the influence of online buying? Because this provides you a way to bargain, because if you find something cheaper online, you can go to the local store and see if they will meet the price. Now, that doesn't usually work at the box stores. They just say, buy it online if you want it. But I wonder if you'd like to comment on what online buying has done to this sort of thing. And I'll hang up and listen to your comments.
Thank you.
Yeah, as I said, I mean, they used to think that the Internet would be a great boon for consumers because everyone could compare prices and no one would ever again have to pay more than the rock-bottom price. But they have taken some defensive measures. There are so many different models of things like electronics now that it can be very hard to find a local store that's offering exactly the same thing at the exact same price. And any time you have to estimate, you know, is this a better product or not? Is this worth paying $10 more, or am I better off driving across town? Then you're very influenced by these heuristics, as they call it, which are these mental shortcuts, which often set you astray. So far, there really hasn't been that big an influence of the Internet buying in terms of getting better prices. Again, you have so many demands on your attention that it's kind of tough to get people to really do all the research they should.
On again to another caller here, line one. This is Urbana. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
The author is certainly experienced in the book industry, and I would like to hear his comments about electronic books, which seem to be kind of a really fast-growing thing, and I'm one that likes to see and hold the paper copy or the hardcover, but what comments would the author have about electronic books? And it must affect the publisher, the retailer, as well as the author. Look forward to hearing. Thanks.
Yeah, well, of course, the recent dispute has been between Amazon and Apple. Apple is Amazon tends to have bestsellers at $9.99 for an electronic book. And Apple has a new plan where they would be like $12.99 to $14.99. So there's a lot of debate over what people will be willing to pay. I actually wrote a blog post on this. I'm a pretty avid reader, and I think that if books were absolutely free, I wouldn't read any more than I do now, just because, you know, it's really the time and attention that limits how many books I can read. And if books cost twice what they did, I suppose I would read almost as much because, again, I like books and it's just something I do. So they're trying to figure out what is the optimum price point there. So I think you're going to find a lot of different experimentation there. But what you will find is that they'll be using those prices ending in 9 because that just seems to be incredibly effective.
Yeah, I have a couple of minutes left. One more caller. Champagne, line 2. Hello.
Hello. I was calling about unit pricing. I was in the store. I saw 2 items, same thing, one twice as big as the other. One marked $3.29, one $4.29. And I noticed on the unit pricing, the one on the larger item was a great deal more than the one on the higher priced. And I noticed, and I've noticed this over and over in the grocery store, they will, the two different sizes, one will be priced by the ounce, one will be priced by the pound.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, you know, I think, and I watched people going by that, it was really quite a bargain, and it was right in front of them, but they wouldn't buy twice as much for a dollar more.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking that, I mean, that unit pricing was supposed to work to our advantage, but I think stores are using that to kind of go in the other direction, because I don't know how many people stopped to read that and take note that one was priced by the pound,
mm-hmm,
and one by the ounce.
Yeah, exactly. That's something people tend not to do. And as they've shown, people have a very limited capacity to hold more than like two or three numbers in their mind at once. Another thing you find, people tend to assume that the larger size is a better deal. But it's hard to compare. And a lot of these places like Costco, you'll find that certain things are a better deal, but other things really aren't.
We're almost to the point we have to finish. So much more I wish I could ask. One question that I do want to ask, though, is this gender play a role here, and do men and women think very differently about these things?
Yeah, they've found in economic experiments that that's true, that unfortunately both men and women tend to offer less to women in bargaining situations and tend to demand more from women. So you almost can't simply call it sexism, because women do it too. And you see that reflected in the supermarkets. A lot of things, there'll be a women's version of like shaving cream or soap or something. It will almost always have less product and cost more money. And it's just because they've found that in certain product categories, women are less price sensitive.
Hmm. Overall, any last little bit of counsel that you can give to people to try it at least to be smarter shoppers?
Well, I think you just have to be aware of these tricks. That's the best defense that you can really have, and realize that sometimes you are going to be tricked.
All right. If you'd like to read more on this subject, look for the book Priceless, The Myth of Fair Value and How to Take Advantage of It. It's by our guest William Poundstone, published by Hill and Wang. He's the author of a number of nonfiction books, so you can look for them at the library or the bookstore. Mr. Poundstone, thanks very much.
Thank you.